Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 147 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Profession That Found WSU's Tim Murray, about my conversation with the chairman of the Department of Plant Pathology in the College of Agriculture, Human, and Natural Resource Sciences at Washington State University. I've known Murray professionally during my entire career in agriculture. When I was a reporter, he was among the first experts I'd contact when a new or resurgent disease or plant pathogen reared its head. The guy was unflappable, calm and collected. No skies fell when Murray spoke. I may have stumbled upon part of the reason why when I visited his office in Johnson Hall on October 4th, 2019. That's when I discovered from the photos he has displayed on his desk that he is also the father of three daughters, all within a year or two of my own daughter's ages. For my part, anyway, that helps explain Murray's unruffled demeanor and reinforces my respect for the guy. Murray was named chairman of the plant pathology department last summer, the second time he has led it. His first tour began in 2000 and ended in 2008. As the current chairman, Murray will continue his extension plant pathology duties. That's good, because as you'll hear ahead, there's a couple of new additions to the complex stew of diseases that eastern Washington farmers face, particularly a new one vectored by a nematode. Like me, Murray is a city boy. A move from Southern California to Northern California, a brush with agriculture in high school, and a teacher's suggestion were the trifecta that wound up impacting the rest of his life. Opportunities like his, however, are growing more infrequent as agriculture consolidates and fewer individuals grow up on a farm, let alone have a brush with one. And fewer homegrown plant pathologists leaves more openings for foreign students who come to the U.S. to study, but then find jobs in the discipline. Before we get to that part of our conversation, as you might expect from the title of the episode, which refers to Murray's found profession, I wanted to understand how a person becomes a plant pathologist. As I observed as we talked in his office on the third floor of Johnson Hall on the WSU campus, it's not exactly a profession children dream about for their future. He explained how it happened.
Well, that's a really good question. We talk about it a lot, actually, those of us who've gone into this profession, how we found ourselves here, because it is really what we call a found profession. You don't go to college, at least in the United States. Most people don't go to college thinking they're going to be a plant pathologist. For me, I had a couple of unusual circumstances that I ended up being in plant pathology. But that's how a lot of people do, is they end up with some kind of an experience, either a university research project that they get involved with, or a summer job, or something like that gets them involved in or makes them aware that this profession exists.
And what was it that made you aware?
Well, I grew up in Southern California as a city boy, and when I was in high school, my family moved to Northern California in a very rural area, Clear Lake. And the two things that were, besides tourism, that went on there, they grew pears and they grew walnuts. And there weren't a lot of jobs for kids in the summer. And so I got a job working on a pear ranch. And I had various jobs, but one of them was we would go through the orchard in this contraption that the grower had built. The tractor pulled basically a trailer that had a column built on it, and we each had to look in the trees at different levels and find this disease called fire blight. And it was easy to spot once you knew what you were looking for. And then the control was, once you saw something, you would yell out, they would stop, get out the pruning shears, cut this bit of tree out, throw it on the trailer, and then you would go on your way. And so we went through the orchard, you know, multiple times during the summer. It's a bacterial disease, and then they pile it all up and burn it, and that was one of the controls. And so that's how I first became aware of plant diseases, and I was always interested. I didn't know you could actually make a living doing that, and so when I went to college, I was interested in microbiology, and I thought that I would be more of a medical microbiologist working in a lab or that kind of a thing. Like often happens, I ran into a teacher. It was a botany teacher. I'd taken this intro to botany, and just one of those guys who helps the light bulb go off. And he's the one who said, "Have you ever thought about marrying these two, you know, microbiology and botany?" And so I went from there. I was at a junior college, and he said, "We got this really great school down the road, UC Davis. That's where you ought to go."
Isn't that amazing? These things just change your life forever.
They do, and it's funny how many people that you talk to who are in the profession, they've had some kind of experience. That's not what they were thinking they wanted to do, and but that's where they end up. And that's mostly in the U.S. You know, a lot of people, a lot of our students, about half or so, come from other countries, international countries. And in a lot of those countries where agriculture is a much more important part of the economy than it is here in the U.S., they have agricultural colleges, and so they get into a track where they know they're going to be learning about agriculture, and so they're introduced to the topic as part of their early curriculum. And so some of our students that come from overseas, they go into that with a much different idea about what plant pathology is and how they might make a living at it.
But those people as well probably are living on the farm before they get to their agricultural college.
Right, and that's exactly right, is you have a much greater percentage of the population who's involved in farming, unlike the U.S., where it's such a small percentage. People aren't really engaged in farming. In fact, you know, in my years of teaching, that was one of the things that I kind of lived through, that age where, you know, a lot of people weren't exactly sure where their food came from beyond the local grocery store. And trying to make students aware of food production and, you know, the hazards associated with food production, not just diseases, but weather and other things that can go wrong.
Let's say, for instance, that an 18-year-old came to you today and said, you know, gosh, what should I do? Would you suggest plant pathology?
Well, it depends. It depends what they're interested in. And plant pathology now, like a lot of agricultural disciplines, is so much more than what it used to be in the past. And this, of course, it's a challenge to get students into agriculture in the first place today because of the image that agriculture has in a lot of parts of the country. It's not a good image, you know. I mean, all of the anti-agriculture people, you know, it's the Monsanto, it's the spray plane flying over spreading pesticides. But, you know, it's really a highly technical science. There's so many things that you can do. I mean, I call myself a translational person because we have some more basic stuff that we do in the lab, but we also try to move that into the field. So we don't just work in the field. That's the image of agricultural research. And some people are really quite basic scientists investigating, you know, the basic characteristics of the organisms that cause disease. So much of it is really basic, fundamental molecular work. And what's interesting about it is that many of the techniques, but several techniques, really important fundamental techniques that are used today in medicine, originated in plant pathology. You talk about things like ELISA tests and things like that, these dipstick tests. A lot of them originated in agriculture, not in human medicine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The gene editing, CRISPR-Cas9, it
right.
seems like it would be ripe for just going in and editing out the problem with the disease.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, modern technology has definitely changed the way we look at things, and provided opportunities to deal with diseases in a way that we've never dealt with before. And that's, you know, that's part of the technology bit about, you know, would a student be interested in plant pathology? Depends what they like to do, but there's a lot of different opportunities there. Yeah, technology has changed the way we do things, but, you know, in order to use a really sophisticated technique like CRISPR-Cas9, you have to have a lot of understanding of the system you're working with. I mean, you have to know the sequences of the DNA of the genes that are important that you want to target, and you'd have to know which genes are important. And in a lot of cases, we don't know that. It's not just a kind of a random technique that you apply. You have to have a lot of really basic knowledge. And, you know, right now, for example, the last few days, I've read headlines about we've got this new banana disease. It's not actually a new disease, but this Fusarium wilt tropical race 4 that really threatens banana production and the Cavendish banana that the whole industry is built on. And they've talked about, well, could CRISPR-Cas9 help us solve this problem? It's interesting. It's yes, there's potential there for it. Will the public accept it? That's another bigger question about gene editing. Just like the controversy we've had over genetically modified organisms that are still, there's real polarization in the public about whether that's acceptable or not. And the same kind of argument is being developed about CRISPR-Cas9. So it's a technique that offers a tremendous potential, but is it ever going to make its way into actual practice? You know, it's hard to say.
Tim, of course, I know you as an individual who studies wheat diseases. I mean,
right.
Do you study other? I mean, are you the wheat guy, or are you do a lot of crops?
Well, I mainly do wheat. I was one of the people around here who was hired with commodity responsibility. So I'm supposed to work on small grains, but effectively I work on wheat because it's what most people are growing for the cash crop. I do work on other diseases as they come along. In fact, we have an interesting project that we're working on. I think it's interesting anyway. It's a bacterial disease of grasses. And it's called bacterial head blight. And I started working on this really as a curiosity in my graduate career. What's interesting to me about this is it's a bacterial disease that's transmitted by a nematode that feeds on plants. And it really, in the U.S., it's not a disease of economic concern. It's more a curiosity. And the biology is pretty interesting because you've got two organisms that we typically associate with wet environments, and both the bacterium and the nematode that transmit it are species that have adapted for survival in dry areas.
So you're bringing up nematodes, and of course there are nematodes,
right,
are a problem in wheat. My question is, I always thought it was just the nematodes were eating the roots of the wheat,
right,
plant. I mean, is it possible that these nematodes that we have now are actually transmitting bacterium to the wheat plant?
Well, the nematodes that we have in wheat are probably not, that we know of, transmitting anything to the wheat plant. There certainly are nematodes that are associated with transmission of viruses in other crops, but not so far as we know in wheat. The nematodes that we have in wheat are a concern because of the damage they cause, and we have really two different types of nematodes. We have the so-called Praetolincus nematodes, which are a migratory type of nematode. They basically burrow into the root, through the root, and move on to other roots, and they cause a lot of damage when they do that. And they do open up the door for other organisms to move in and infect the roots. The other type are the cyst nematodes, cereal cyst nematodes, and those nematodes, the young nematodes, burrow into the root. They find one spot and they remain there for life. that's a really specialized kind of a relationship. They mostly don't cause these other kinds of secondary wounds that we think about that allow other organisms to move into the roots. So they do cause damage on their own, but so far as we know, like I said, they're not transmitting other pathogens to the wheat plant.
And it's interesting. I mean, 20 years ago, we weren't even talking about nematodes.
Right.
You know, damage? No, nematodes aren't damaging the wheat.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and it's interesting, if you go back even farther in history, back into the 40s, post-World War II, we didn't really appreciate how much damage nematodes were causing in agriculture until the advent of soil fumigants, which came out in the 1940s. Once we were able to start fumigating soil, we saw these tremendous yield responses, and they've been attributed to different things. Some of them are certainly other soil-borne plant pathogens, but nematodes too are causing a big loss. And you know, I have no doubt Dick Smiley's done a great job documenting the issues that we have in the Pacific Northwest and the losses using fumigation and other techniques, and I have no doubt that the nematodes are out there causing damage now. The more we look, the more we find.
Have we passed the golden age of plant pathology and what is out there to find, and that now you are just sort of needling around with the very small stuff, or is there still a lot more to discover?
Well, I think there's a lot more to discover, and I think in terms of finding new things, every once in a while we find something new. More likely, it's the things that we know about that are going to change. You know, I give you an example. There's bags sitting on my desk right there by your shoulder. That's a disease called Septoria triticae blotch. Septoria triticae blotch is a very significant problem in places like the Willamette Valley of Oregon. California, they spend $1 billion a year in Europe on fungicides alone to control that disease. It's the most significant foliar disease of wheat in Europe. In Washington State, Eastern Washington, we've known that we have one of the two pathogens that causes that disease. We've known that for a long time. I knew this as a grad student 40 years ago, that we had that pathogen here. We can find it on lower leaves after winter, early spring, late winter. It's on the lower leaves. But our environment really isn't favorable for that disease to move up and really cause damage. Last year, while I was attending variety trials, I collected that disease two different locations from flag leaves. And in one of those two locations, it was in some varieties, it was probably enough that it was causing some damage. Now, you know, I'm not trying to wave a red flag here about this, but it's an emerging problem. I saw it enough that it causes me concern to think that this is a problem that's on the horizon.
So, and what about the changing climate? One could only assume that as the climate changes, this might become a bigger problem.
Well, and that's probably why we are seeing it emerge, because last year was not a particularly wet year, but we know that winter is getting shorter. Winter conditions are getting shorter. We have more frost-free days. We have warmer night temperatures, especially are really important. We underestimate that, and so the climate is changing, and in subtle ways. And this is kind of what we expect to see, is that we're going to see a shift in the spectrum of diseases that occur on a regular basis and are important. And so this is an example, I think, of that. We could also look to stripe rust, which has been our most important foliar disease over the last 50 years. And if Raleigh Lyne were here, he would tell you that over the course of his career, he would see a major epidemic about every 10 years or so. Well, since 2010, stripe rust has been a concern every year, except for this last year. it's becoming more of a problem. And I think it's an example of what happens when the climate is changing. It's becoming more favorable for some of these diseases for various reasons.
And yet we have, you know, a lot of private companies out there coming up with different chemicals, you know, modern resistance genes. Are private companies solving the problem that universities used to address?
Well, I think, I mean, there's always been the large private companies producing fungicides. That's gone on for a long time, and it certainly helped alleviate some of the problems that we have. You know, I can think back to early in my career, we were spraying almost 1 million acres a year with a fungicide for control of eye spot. And that was a great stopgap until we were able to move resistance genes into varieties that were adapted to the area. And then since then, those resistance genes have really dominated for control of that disease. But we still have a significant acreage that gets sprayed with the fungicide for eye spot. So even though they've helped solve the problem, they haven't completely solved it. In the case of stripe rust, it's a lot more complex situation because of the relationship between the pathogen and the plant and the nature of the resistance genes and so forth. The resistance is not durable. The pathogen has opportunities to change genetically, and so it's a moving target. Fungicides certainly help with that, but it's going to be a moving target going forward. I have no doubt of that. It's not going to be a problem that there's this silver bullet that we find that's going to cure it.
And yet we do have some silver bullets out there.
I mean,
Dividend has been a heck of a silver bullet when it comes to things like TCK smut.
Yep.
And then, you know, also years ago, flag smut was just a huge problem here. Both of those have been taken care of.
They have. And those are great examples of where we've had an intervention of a chemical. You know, Vitavax early on controlled not only flag smut, but it helped control common smut too. But common smut wasn't controlled alone by chemicals. It took both resistance and an effective seed treatment to control common bunt. TCK was a harder one to deal with because of the nature of the disease and the pathogen and so forth. But you're right, Dividend has done a great job in controlling that problem. But you know the old saying, nature abhors a vacuum. You take care of one thing and something else moves in to fill that vacuum. We haven't seen it with the cereal smuts, fortunately, but there certainly are other problems that we're working on now that we weren't working on 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have soil-borne wheat mosaic virus now down in the Walla Walla area. It seems to be confined down there, but that's a major problem in other parts of the world. In the U.S., here we have a virus that's transmitted by a soil-borne protist that is long-lived in the soil, so that once a field is contaminated, it's basically contaminated for the duration.
What's a soil-borne protist?
Well, it is an organism. In this case, it is a fungus-like organism. Once upon a time, we called them fungi, but as we got to know more through molecular tools about the evolutionary lineages of these things, we realized that they weren't, in fact, fungi. Just like we used to call these organisms, like Pythium, we used to call them fungi. We now know that they're more closely related to seaweed than they are to fungi. So it's just a different class of organisms that we call the protista. They're typically more simple organisms, but they all fall in that spectrum of microorganisms that live in the soil.
But Walla Walla has these organisms?
Well, the actual organism itself is quite widespread. We could probably find it in many soils in Washington State. What's interesting about the Walla Walla area is that there's a virus that's associated with it. They're not always together, but when the virus is present, then the organism is able to transmit it to the wheat plant.
Fascinating, yeah. Fascinating. And so that, like those aphids that fly up.
That's exactly right. Except in this case, they're soil borne. They don't move long distances. They typically are moved on soil that's probably stuck to somebody's tires or shoes or something like that.
And we don't understand why this particular protist has collected the virus.
No. Like these relationships with what we call a vector, the vector and the relationship with the pathogen. These we don't know why they evolved the way they do. But there's actually a group of viruses that are associated with this particular organism that are transmitted. We have only one of them here mm-hmm. in the Northwest. There are two other viruses of wheat that are transmitted by the same organism, and so fortunately we only have one. And fortunately we have one of the controls is disease resistance. So we do have effective resistance genes that the breeders are working with now to incorporate into varieties.
I didn't know how to spell Proteus, let alone know they existed before this podcast. So you see, I'm learning right along with you, my faithful podcast listeners. I continue my conversation with Murray next week when we'll talk about the incredible diversity and number of soil microorganisms and their effect on soil health, the status of snow mold as an ongoing problem, the impact that declining soil pH has on diseases, and much more. Please join me here again next time for episode 148, the second part of The Profession That Found WSU's Tim Murray, Chairman of the Department of Plant Pathology and WSU Extension Plant Pathologist, right here on Weed All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.